And did you want your testifiers up with you at the table at the same time?
Madam Chair, can I ask a question? Oh, yeah. We don't have sound yet.
Hello. They're just...
Oh, okay. That's all right. We don't have to have super a lot of volume. Is this an informational hearing?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yep. Is that better?
Oh,
yeah, I think you were right. So then do we need to...
You're recording. This wasn't broadcast.
Okay. Okay. Representative Murphy, if you just want to go, and then if you could just have your witnesses state their name for the tape, too, before they start.
Yes. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I have to say this is the first time I've been at this table to testify, and it is a lovely room, but there's a great amount of distance between us right here. I want to thank you very much for hearing. That was nice. For conducting an informational hearing about House File 3728, which has as its intention to create an external and expert body that would take up issues of harassment and assault that are a part of our legislative experience. I think it is important that we consider this issue, and I am grateful for the subcommittee's interest in this among the variety of issues that you are considering as we think about this beloved institution and how we make sure that this is a workplace and a place where Minnesotans can come and feel both safe and respected in their participation in our democracy. I want to begin by recognizing my friend, Lindsay Port, who is here, and to recognize Representative Erin McQuaid, who is not here, two women that I have been working with now for quite some time on the issue of sexual assault and sexual harassment, and they are both familiar with this proposal. And I want it to be clear and on the record that it is has been my practice and my intention to work with the people who have been impacted by issues of sexual assault and sexual harassment, and in fact, I think they are our leaders and the people that can guide us most wisely as we move forward here and across the state of Minnesota. I want to begin by acknowledging that I am a nurse and I come from a female-dominated profession. And when we think about the issue before us, we are indeed talking about power and in many cases the abuse of power. I was a surgical nurse both in Wisconsin and then at the University of Minnesota. And I remember many examples of harassment that occurred, not always sexual harassment, but an abuse of power in a hierarchical system that rewarded that hierarchy. Surgical nursing is a very hierarchical setting, and we deal with sharp instruments and body fluids that can carry disease. So it is something that we are careful about. And I remember a time when we were working in a stressful situation and a surgeon was feeling frustrated by the nursing staff who were reminding him about aseptic technique. And as a result of his frustration, left the side of the patient with his hands covered in blood and spread that blood around the room to remind us that it was our job to clean that up as a means to remind us of our place in the pecking order, as a means to remind us of the hierarchy of power in that institution. We are dealing with similar issues, and we know it now across this country in workplaces, on college campuses, and indeed in this beloved institution. And I think it is time for us to make sure that we recognize that power differential, how it can impact people's relationships and really the function of what we do here. In 2010, I was grateful to work with a number of legislators and the organization MnCASA, the Coalition Working Against Sexual Assault. They wanted to find funding for the Department of Health to prevent sexual assault, and I remember having a conversation with a couple of my colleagues, and we all felt a little uncomfortable with the way that we talk about intimacy and sex used as violence. And as a result of those early conversations, the legislature, both the House and the Senate, created a caucus where we together as legislators could talk together and get a little more facile in the conversation that we needed to have around sexual assault and sexual harassment. That caucus was a useful tool, and I wish we still had it in place. And we did work to secure some funding for the Department of Health and their work to prevent sexual assault. In 2014, I began doing work on college campuses with college campus leaders on the idea of affirmative consent and consent, which is really the underlying change that we need to make if we want to prevent further sexual assault and sexual humiliation and sexual violence. But right now, we're not talking about how we're preventing it. Right now, we're talking about how we're going to make sure our workplace is more safe and more secure, that whether we're elected officials, staff people, citizens, or lobbyists, that we have a reliable place to go if we have been the victim of assault or abuse. And that is why this piece of legislation is before you today. There are two women that live in the district I represent, Kathy Ganatek and Rebecca Larson. They did a fair amount of work in the wake of the revelations of Senator Schoen and Representative Cornish and came to me with this idea. I think it is worthy of your consideration, and I'd like to turn my testimony over to them and then to Lisa Stratton from Gender Justice, and they can explain a little bit more about why they think this is so important. And then we'll take your questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, and Representative Murphy, I'm Kathy Ganatek, and I'm here today in support of HF 3728. Our bill is a common-sense solution to the fact that the system to address harassment in the House is broken. It has failed. None of the stakeholders have been provided with what they need. The people who have been harassed, whether members of the House, lobbyists, or constituents, have no clear avenue to present their concerns and demand culture change. As such, they are forced to resort to the media. Similarly, no clear path exists for members who are accused of ethical violations. As Madam Chair has indicated, they end up feeling they have been unfairly tried in the court of public opinion. This structure leads to a zero-sum game where everyone loses and sees the other as the enemy. I'd like to tell a story now that might help shift us out of this men versus women, Republican versus Democrat, us versus them mentality, and open the possibility for the House to consider the win-win solution to the problem that our bill proposes. Recently, in a conversation with my friends Jim and Fred, I was challenging something Jim said. Rather than respond, Jim turned to Fred and said something about my breasts and made a motion about them as well. Did Jim do this because he was all of a sudden attracted to me? No. It seems more likely he felt diminished. And without thinking, he used sex as a weapon, not because he's an evil person, but because it was easy. He'd learned it growing up. It was a dumb, unthinking way to knock me off my feet and regain the upper hand. And it worked. Even though I'm a trial lawyer and by training, and by all accounts a very strong woman, I felt humiliated, and I couldn't find words to respond, so I shut up. As human beings, we're all vulnerable to hurting people when we feel threatened. You could change the story and put me in Jim's place, making a racist comment to a black friend when I felt backed into a corner. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not excusing Jim's behavior or saying that every harasser is as mild or as dumb as my friend. What I am saying is that a great deal of harassment is dumb, unthinking, and grounded in culture, which is the good news. As you heard last week, years of work in the employment field has shown that we can learn how to treat each other with respect, and cultures can change. I also tell this story because it shows that often harassment has nothing to do with sex and everything to do with power. The House Ethics Committee, though well-intentioned, lacks both the independence and resources necessary to assess harassment complaints. Our bill solves this problem by proposing a nonpartisan citizens' council with the expertise and objectivity to create and implement a complaint system. Since the Ethics Committee cannot delegate its powers to an outside body, the council is advisory in nature. It would provide a full and fair hearing on complaints and provide detailed reports and recommendations for action by the Ethics Committee. HF 3728 is a win-win situation for all concerned. It has the potential to provide much-needed clarity and certainty about process for all parties, which in turn lays the groundwork for a positive change in culture for the House of Representatives. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the subcommittee for the opportunity to speak with you on HF 3728. And thank you, Representative Murphy, for presenting this bill. My name is Rebecca Larson. I'm from St. Paul, and I was driven to act on the issue of harassment in our society
because I believe everyone deserves to work in a safe place in order to do their best work. I recently retired from a 25-year career as an IT executive in a Fortune 500 company that had common decency as a company value, a very pure and simple goal. As an employee, I was required to attest that I understood the code of ethics, to attend training on harassment, hostile work environments, and the process for addressing complaints. As a leader, I also knew what was expected of me. These activities, though mandatory, sent a clear message that harassment would not be tolerated and would be addressed with urgency and fairness. These were high-priority efforts that supported the desired corporate culture. When I saw Erin May Quaid and Lindsay Port tell their stories of sexual harassment at the legislature to the media, I asked myself, what is going on? Do you really need to put your career on the line and be a superhero to get your story heard? For the accused, where was the due process? And are there others with similar experiences but who didn't want to take the risk of telling their stories to the media? What was their recourse? Didn't the legislature have policies and procedures like I had seen in a corporate environment? And if not, why not? So I ask, what is the desired culture at the legislature? A culture free of harassment? A culture that evens the playing field for women and people of all protected classes who want to enter politics or work in government? A culture where our elected officials and all who work with them are able to focus on the jobs they were elected and are paid to do? One of common decency? I hope for all of those things. Harassment in the legislature, when it occurs, and especially if it is not dealt with, leads to greater distrust of elected officials in the communities they represent. Pass this legislation and send a message to all Minnesota citizens, to legislative staff, to lobbyists, that harassment will not be tolerated, regardless of political party. When organizations take strong stands, supported by strong policies, processes, and consequences rooted in justice, then and only then can the culture begin to change. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for inviting me, Representative Murphy, and to my colleagues here for really helpful insights that ground what I'm about to say to you. I am Lisa Stratton. I'm an attorney, and I have been a litigator for over 20 years in representing people, including in sexual harassment cases. Gender discrimination has been the focus of my career. I founded Gender Justice to create another voice for people in the state who are harassed based on gender and race, and do so through litigation and policy work before you and other policymakers, and through training. So we do provide some training for employers. And I decided in the short time that we have here today to look through some of the past reports I've had in my cases from experts who are testifying about what organizations should do and how organizations have gone wrong, and to pull out some of the most salient pieces of what the best practices are and what the social science research shows about institutions such as this one. The law has created a powerful incentive for employers to have effective preventive and corrective policies and to implement them. And these experts testify about whether that's being done effectively in a particular workplace or organization. And this is the kind of research to tie this to the bill that I would expect that the Citizen Council on Legislative Ethics, that House File 3728, as introduced by Representative Murphy today, would draw upon and make recommendations to this body for how to implement. So to just draw upon a few central conclusions out of this large body of research. Number one, there is no typical harasser. That is, research has not identified any pattern of demographic or interpersonal characteristics of a typical harasser. And I think this is probably one of the most salient messages from the Me Too movement and the stories that have come forward online, in the media, in person, through the folks outside the hearing today who brought some of their personal stories. The fact is that someone can be seemingly a nice person. We can like them and respect them, but that is not a reliable indicator that they are not ever going to sexually harass anyone. While it's true that some individuals are more likely to, and that there tend to be repeat patterns of harassment, the propensity to harass is grounded in things like beliefs about the proper roles for men and women. I think this harkens back to use of power as a central determinant of what is harassment. So if we can't easily identify potential harassers, so how can an institution like this legislature intervene to prevent it, to prevent sexual harassment and create a safe work environment that we know is everyone's goal here? The good news for those in charge of institutions is that it's also well accepted by experts that organizational conditions are, in fact, the most powerful predictors of sexual harassment. Studies have drawn common traits, indicators of organizations that typically have the greatest problems with sexual harassment. And they share the following characteristics. A skewed gender ratio, that is, most employees are male and there are relatively few women. There are job duties and tasks that are historically masculine in nature or assumed to be men's work, so to speak. And here is, I think, the most important one, organizational tolerance of offensive behavior. Organizational climate is the single most powerful factor in determining whether sexual harassment will occur and how damaging it is when it does. Conversely, studies have shown that strict management norms and a climate that does not tolerate offensive behavior can inhibit harassment, even by those with a propensity to do so. There's another entire body of research, as you might expect, on the impact of gender-based harassment on victims. The main finding in this area is that harassment is more common and targets have worse outcomes in settings that are tolerant of the behavior. Those studies draw out that tolerance, as they review it, is comprised of not taking the issue seriously, there being a high risk for complaining, and there being little chance that perpetrators will be sanctioned. So in other words, an organizational tolerance of harassment can be defined as the general perception among employees and other participants in the environment that there is little that can or will be done to prevent or remediate it, combined with elevated levels of risk to victims for complaining. Other important indicators of tolerance are a lack of policies or procedures for dealing with sexual harassment and behavior, again, that appears to tolerate it. Importantly, I think often people who report are singled out as it's only about you or this is your problem or this is a very small or isolated problem, when the research actually demonstrates, when it comes to harm to the victims, that being in an environment where other women are being harassed, combined with a tolerant climate, can produce psychological distress to those targeted, that is, or to those not targeted, that's equivalent to those directly harassed. And one conclusion that, again, ties into what Representative Murphy observed in her work environment, I've observed in many, is, and it seems particularly relevant to this setting, where harassers may be elected officials, is that harassment by someone in a position of authority and control is always experienced as more severe. So I could talk on and on about research. I know you don't want me to, and I know we don't have time for it, but I want to say that my message here, if there's a single message from my testimony here today, is that sexual harassment is preventable, and that the single most important component of creating a safe environment at this legislature and one that is most within this body's control, they are one and the same, is demonstrating through both words and action that sexual harassment is not and will not be tolerated. Representative Murphy has brought before you a bill that I think would allow for the development of policies and practices that meet these criteria, that speak to where this body can do better on all of these recommended practices and the research behind them, and sets up a process and a mechanism for doing so. Culture change within an institution is possible. We do know what it takes. It can be done. And this bill is one example of a way to start making it happen here. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Do members have questions? If not, I do have some procedural questions. Just looking at your bill, Representative Murphy, I'm just trying to figure out procedurally, and I think somebody mentioned that it would be advisory to the Ethics Committee, so I was just looking through it, particularly on line 1.19 where it says adoption, they'd be adopting the procedures for receiving and processing the complaints, and then on line 2.11 it talks about public hearings to establish probable cause, and then on line 2.14 it talks about requirements for the use of closed meetings. So could you talk just a little bit about how this would, I'm trying to work my way around how that would work in practice. So if a legislator had a complaint, they would come, or somebody had a complaint, they'd come here, and then this advisory council would have a probable cause hearing open to the public or not open to the public to discuss the specific complaint?
Or how would that work? Would it be okay with you if we ask Mr. McCormick to come up and help us out?
Sure,
yes. He is the drafter of this legislation.
Yep. I'm just trying to wrap my arms around it procedurally about exactly what they do in relation to what, how it would interact with our Ethics Committee and our current human resources policy.
And before Mr. McCormick begins, I do want to say that I think that our Human Resources Department, in the work that I have done with them, they have done wonderful work.
I agree. Thank you for saying that. Did you follow that, Mr. McCormick, the kind of the question I was asking? Just procedurally, I'm wondering how it works. If somebody had a complaint, they'd go here, and then a little bit more about the probable cause hearing and if that's transparent to the public or if it's closed and how exactly that would work, and then what happens when they've determined that there is a cause for action, then how that interacts with the Ethics Committee and also with our Human Resources Department.
Chair members, the draft requires this group to create procedures that would fit exactly what you're asking for. So, for example, on page 2, lines 1.4 to 1.6, this group would have to establish written procedures to specify when closed meetings would be used to consider confidential matters, and that mirrors to some extent the current Ethics Committee's procedures to use closed, but it could differ because this group could modify and change those and adopt those in a slightly different or maybe more detailed than our current. Most of this draft then requires this group to specify and design procedures. The Ethics Committees of the House and the Senate have written adopted procedures that are 15, 20 pages long with a lot of detail that's been refined over the years. And so my thought would be that a group like this would take a look at those procedures, modify them, amend them, adopt them publicly at a meeting of the commission, and then go forward using those adopted procedures. The one specific answer I can give is about probable cause or the reports. And under the authority of this group on page 2, lines 1 and 2, they have the authority to complete reports, which are on any submitted complaint, and forward those to the Ethics Committee. And this is also reiterated on page 3, lines 7 through 13. They make explicit complaint reports to the Ethics Committees of the relative House or House and Senate if that complaint takes you to both bodies. And they're allowed to redact, with the advice of counsel, any details that have resulted from confidential hearings or from a confidential complaint. And then they advise the relevant House as to their findings of probable cause to any of the findings that they may have made. One ambiguity in this draft, as I read it, I'm just writing a note to myself, is the ambiguity about whether this group is going to do a probable cause finding and report to the Ethics Committee or do a completed investigation with a recommended disciplinary action and report it to the Ethics Committee. As I read this draft, they could choose to do either. It's allowed or layered into this draft that they could, on a particular complaint, decide we have probable cause and are turning it over to the Ethics Committee of the Senate. Or they could decide we've gone past probable cause and conducted an investigation and are turning over recommended punishment. Because this is layered beside existing rules of the House and Senate for ethics, I would think that the next step, if this was passed into law, would be for the House and Senate to revise their own rules and procedures to dovetail better with this new commission. And that would mean, for example, you wouldn't want a redundant investigation where this group completed an investigation and the ethics group did an investigation unless the Ethics Committee perhaps voted or decided. But that would be something that would have to be discussed by the Rules Committee of the House or the Senate. How do you want those ethics committees to dovetail with this once it's in law, or if it is in law? So there are some ambiguities that need to be worked out both in legislation, I would say, and in our ethics procedures should this pass to make it work.
Sure. Just some follow-up questions. I'm not sure who wants to answer, but Representative Murphy, so, I mean, obviously that we'd have to have a little bit more detail in here if we were to proceed. So what would, and this might be a question for Mr. McCormick, I'm not sure. So I guess, first of all, do you have a timeline in mind of when someone would have to respond or the Ethics Committee would have to respond and what would happen if we weren't in session, I guess? And then also what would be the requirement, the legal requirement of the Ethics Committee based on whatever their probable cause or whatever their investigation would reveal? So you might know part of that answer, and maybe Mr. McCormick could dovetail on whatever part you didn't have an answer for.
And Chair and members, as I think about this, and to your first question about the timeline or timing if we weren't in session, I think we would have to answer that question as a legislative body just as we would any other issue that would come before the Ethics Committee. And because I've never served on the Ethics Committee, I'm not sure that body can be convened in the absence of the legislature. So I think we would have to conform this to that process. The Ethics Committee, once getting a report, would, as I understand it, in this proposal, operate in the same way that it currently does. What this proposal offers us is the creation of an external advisory but expert body to handle the question. Right now we have an HR department that can take these up and an ethics committee that can take these up, but the ethics committee is made up of us essentially. And so the idea behind this, I think the operative shift is that we would, instead of sending a complaint raw to the Ethics Committee, it would first go to an external expert body for its consideration and then return to the Ethics Committee and the House and the Senate, because constitutionally that is the body that can deal with the result of an investigation or probable cause.
Sure. And then what would be, I guess, the time frame that you would you want to put a specific time frame in of when they'd have to respond? Or what do you envision for that?
Madam Chair and members, I have not given that question my full consideration and would work with you and with others as we move forward.
Okay. And then, so how would this...
Certainly wouldn't want it to last, you know, like we should contemplate timelines, right? So
yeah.
We don't, as a matter of course, we'll wait and report until after the next election, right?
And then, Representative Murphy, I'm a little concerned about the actual, whatever the probable cause hearing, and I understand that it's not created yet, but are you envisioning that as something that's open to the public? So if Legislator X has a complaint against Legislator Y, when it says open to the public, does that just mean the group of people there, or would it be open to other people such as the media to be there to watch, or what do you have in mind for that? I don't know that it's listed in here, but obviously it'd be something that we'd have to work through.
Right. So, Madam Chair and members, first and foremost, as the bill is drafted, those procedures would be determined by the group, right? So we haven't fully envisioned that. As a matter of practice, I think for men, women, for people who experience assault or sexual violence, when they decide to complain and how they decide to complain remains in their control. And their identity, from my perspective, must be protected until they're ready to be public about that. And I think as I have talked with Mr. McCormick and others about this issue and how we have dealt with these issues in the past, identities aren't always made public because often before there's a full investigation, a member accused resigns, and that often puts an end to the claim. So I would want for this group, as we move forward, to, of course, protect the identity of the person issuing the complaint until the investigation is complete. And I think that the task force that is assembled, the working group assembled, would have the responsibility of creating that process to ensure that integrity, but also to ensure the integrity of this body, that those who choose to go there, whether it is a member, a staff person, a citizen, or a lobbyist, that they have confidence that the claim that they bring forward will be dealt with and dealt with in a uniform way by experts who bring that expertise to the question in a way that they will have confidence in actually moving forward. Because if we want to change culture, one way to change the culture here is to make sure that people know that a claim will be dealt with.
Yeah, I appreciate your thoughts on that. One of the things that I've thought a lot about, obviously we've all thought a lot about this in the last few months, is how do you balance the rights of the victim as well as the accused to make sure that they both have, you know, both their privacy protected and they both have their day in court, so to speak. So that's one of the things that I've thought about a lot through the process.
I just want to say that I think creating a reliable process does protect the interests of all the parties and protects the integrity of this institution.
I may have a couple more questions, but I see other members have some questions now. So Representative Portman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say I think this is the best proposal that's come before the committee. Even including considering mine, because I think that what this does is it puts, you know, the concepts of the task force into place, but further, it also creates a mechanism. And what I've been struggling with is to figure out what is the appropriate entity to receive complaints about legislators. And I really appreciate what you have on page one, or what Pat McCormick has on page one, line 1.14, that the council may not respond to complaints for which an existing statutory entity is explicitly responsible. And then I think we'd have to probably take out legislative employees below because they have a form of recourse through the Human Resources Department. But I think what this does is it fills in the gap for people for whom there is currently no proper place to lodge a complaint other than the media. So I wanted to compliment the folks who put this together and have brought it forward. I think it is the best, most workable thing we've seen. And in terms of cost and bureaucracy, it's also, I think, reasonable in size and manageable to administer through the LCC. So I think it really merits further consideration by the House and the Senate.
Representative Portman, did that make me think of a question about who exactly can bring a complaint here. So would a lobbyist or a member of the media? And also, I think, just reading on line 1.10 and 1.11, it says, a reporting system by which the Minnesota public may initiate complaints against members of the legislature. So could a member of the legislature come forward to bring a complaint against, say, a lobbyist, or would that not be part of it? Have you thought about that? Or would that be allowed under this language?
Mr. McCormick, do you have advice on that?
Madam Chair, members, this is confined to complaints against members of the legislature.
Okay. Did you have a question? Representative O'Driscoll?
I'm sure just kind of going a little slightly different direction. I know that time is a premium because you wanted to kind of wrap this part up, but it occurred to me as I was reading the bill that Subdivision 5 membership, and I would like to ask Representative Murphy, she's contemplated these ideas. It says in the very first part of that that no current or prior member of the legislature is eligible to serve. I'll try to make this in kind of a big question so that you kind of see the direction I'm going, maybe just respond to it in totality. Does that mean that somebody who was a lobbyist, does that mean somebody who was maybe a member of the media has been suggested might have a complaint or a prior staff member could be involved in this? Because I also see that you have in here, it says they have to have human resources background, harassment policy, or legislative ethics. Second part of that is, who's going to determine, is it the appointor that's going to determine the level that they see fit for that office, or is there a criteria that you're going to be establishing that needs to be met in order for the appointor to in essence, select an appointee?
Representative Murphy?
Madam Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, as we worked on this piece of legislation, this was one of the places where we, I think, would want more advice and more thought. Obviously, from my perspective, it is important that we take advantage of the expertise that exists among us to be able to adjudicate these claims. And it is an area of specialty, and we hear it in the testifiers that are here today. I do think that the appointors would have the responsibility at this point to choose people with that expertise. And I will say, in my many years here now in the legislature, this is always an art, drafting legislation about how we build something that has the right kind of expertise. There is the drafting part with the intention and then the appointing part that follows. And we hope always that that works, and I would hope that it does. But if we need in the drafting to be more specific to get the right result, then I would want to work with the legislature if we move beyond an informational hearing on this proposal to make that work. Our intention is to assemble a group that brings expertise to this question and brings confidence to the process to improve where we stand right now on this issue.
I'm here just to
Representative O'Driscoll.
Representative Murphy, I come by this organically as the chair of the Government Operations Committee. This stuff is in our purview, so I get to see and think about this stuff on a real regular basis. So thank you for your response.
Right, thank you. Representative Murphy, I think I asked this to Representative Hortman and Representative May Quaid on their proposals as well. The other thing I've thought about is, you know, obviously as legislators, we're in the public eye and the media follows these types of complaints more than they would in the general public. So what would you envision for this council? Would there be a chair who would be the spokesperson to the media, or how would that work? Would they elect somebody amongst them to be the spokesperson, or what would you envision for that?
Madam Chair and members, it's a fine question for us and for our work as we move forward with this proposal. If you choose to take it up outside of an informational hearing, I would want first and foremost to make sure that the process that's put in place is full of integrity, and that the result of whatever work that they do based on a complaint is handed properly to the Ethics Committee. I do know in the wake of the resignations of Senator Schoen and Representative Cornish that there have been multiple questions about the transparency of this process, the transparency here in the legislature, especially as it relates to publicly elected officials. And while we know the Constitution says it is either the voters or the legislature as a whole that can make a determination about someone's fitness to serve, I think it is an open question about when it is the right of the public to understand if someone has been found. to have committed a violation. And I do think that is a question that we need to take up and wrestle with as public officials as we think about the integrity of this institution. So I don't have a clear conclusion from my perspective about whether or not there would be a spokesperson, someone that would report out to the public or to the media. I think we need to wrestle with that and understand what we think is the right next step for us, the right posture that we want to take. But I am moved by the questions that I've heard from the people who live in the district I represent, from the people who have been talking about this issue, that the lack of transparency around this question is creating, I think, a cloak of doubt around our ability to handle these effectively. And that's no good for this institution. And it is one, as I have said, one that I love and I know that we all do. And it is here where we do the work of the people, and that's why I think it's important that this legislature take action on Representative Portman's proposal, Representative McQuaid's proposal, or this proposal, or some combination thereof, to make sure that we're conveying to the people of Minnesota that we're taking this seriously and that we're moving on it.
Hopefully we'll come up with some good policy ideas. We have heard several proposals, so this is helpful to get ideas from members. I do have one more follow-up question maybe for you, Mr. McCormick. I don't recall NCSL talking about this, but are any other legislators or any other legislatures doing a similar model like this that you know of or have proposals forward?
No. Right now, this would be cutting edge. We have a number of legislatures who have talked about, considered in the recent couple months, whether they should have outside groups, and there aren't any that we're aware of.
Okay, thank you. Are any other member questions? And if not, I'd like to leave this open to the public, if there are members of the public that would like to testify. We did want to thank you all for coming forward.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Is there anyone that would like to testify on this or just kind of in general? Because this is one of the few evening hearings. I'm not sure if we'll have time for another one or not, but I would like to make that available if anybody would like to testify. Do we get any names? Okay. Well, I'm not seeing anyone else. Is there anything else from any other members that they need to bring up tonight? All right, that's all we had for tonight then, and our next meeting is next Monday, March 26th at 9 a.m., so we'll be back on our Monday morning schedule I know you all love so much. So with that, any other questions? All right, meeting's